The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Greenberg. Pleased to welcome everyone to the Carol Phillips Memorial Lecture. It's named in memory of my mother, Carol Phillips, who is a great supporter and friend of the library. As many of you know, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity, from its award-winning author event series to its thought-provoking programs. Please visit freelibrary.org/support to make a gift that will help the library continue to produce such transformative programming. And while you're online, don't forget to sign up for a library card. It's now my pleasure to introduce cartoonist and best-selling author Roz Chast. Best known for her over 800 cartoons in The New Yorker, she has also written and illustrated more than a dozen books, and her work has been featured in Scientific American, the Harvard Business Review, and Mother Jones, among other publications. Her 2014 memoir and cartoon, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, was a New York Times bestseller, finalist for the National Book Award in Nonfiction, and winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. Having grown up in Brooklyn, her heart has always remained in New York, despite a move to the suburbs. Her new book, Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York, began as a guidebook for her daughter as she prepared to move to New York for college. It is an illustrated pay-in, guide, thank-you note to Manhattan, told with nostalgia, wonder, and deft observation. Vogue noted that it reflect an unmitigated adoration of the city, an endless patience for its shortcomings, a full-throated embrace of New York's infinite capacity for change, and a complete lack of snootiness toward those who have less of a native claim to it than she does. We're so pleased to have her here with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Roz Chast to the Free Library.
Hi. I'd like to start out with this slide. It tells you a little bit about where I'm coming from. I'm not really much of a nature girl, though, so it's kind of a lie. But I did have a little bit of this, you know, I did have water. When I was a child, we had hot and cold running water, and sometimes I even took baths. We had an air conditioner. We had a toaster where sometimes I, you know, there were events that happened. And also, occasionally, I did have experience with nature and earth. My mother would sometimes put a avocado pit in a thing of water, and it would grow like a little root, and then she'd put it in a pot, and it would grow like a couple of little leaves, and then it would get thrown away, and then the cycle would begin again. I'm going to start out with a few cartoons. This is Pigeon Little. The sky is falling. The sky is, oh, look, part of a bagel. This is the last Thanksgiving. I figured this is a timely thing. We can't have salt, lactose intolerant, vegetarian, vegan, macrobiotic, fanatic traditionalist, on a cleanse, strictly kosher, ultra picky gourmet, and allergic to gluten. This is the Fountain of Puberty. This is when moms dance. You know, if you've ever been a teenager or have ever had teenagers, you know there's almost nothing more disgusting in the eyes of a teenager than the adult human body. And if you really want to gild that lily, just do a little dance. And one time, my daughter was in the living room. She was about 16 at the time. It was a while ago. You can tell there's a boombox. And she was listening to some hip-hop. And I just wanted to see if she was paying attention. So I kind of came out, and I was doing this little dance. And she looked up, and she actually said, "Mom, stop. You're hurting me." And I asked her if I could use it as a line, and she was okay with that. This, I think... Uh, Yeah. It's a problem. This is the not in the mood for human interaction line. This is just a desk joke. This is too early to begin working on and too late to do anything about. It's the MRI of love. I always think of this guy as Obit Man. He's reading the obituaries. I don't know if you guys ever do this. I always check out, you know, when they died, and I feel cheated if I don't know, like, how they died. I hate it when somebody dies and they're, like, in their 60s and they say natural causes. It's like, what are you talking about? And this is just a kind of general declension. We have... this is the very first cartoon I ever sold to the New Yorker, and I thought I would talk a little bit about this. I always loved to draw from the time I was a little kid, and I liked to draw things that made me laugh. I liked cartoons. I liked things that made me laugh. I liked to draw things that made me laugh. And I spent a lot of time by myself, and sometimes the things that made me laugh were, like, not necessarily what made other people laugh, but they made me laugh, so that was okay. And eventually I sort of found my way by the time I was in my teens that I thought, well, I think I might actually be a cartoonist. And so that was the path I was sort of following, and I went to art school, and when I got out of art school... I was living in Manhattan at that time, and I was actually starting to sell cartoons. I was selling some cartoons to the National Lampoon and also some to the Village Voice. And my secret goal, heart of heart secret goal, was to be a cartoonist for the Village Voice, because that was where Jules Feiffer was published and Stan Mack, Mark Allen Stamaty, and... You know, I love to draw cartoons, but I didn't quite see where my stuff fit in. It did not look like newspaper cartoons. I didn't think the underground scene was quite right. Overground wasn't right. Underground wasn't right. But something about the Village Voice seemed very idiosyncratic, and I thought I could find a home there. Nevertheless, even though I was starting to sell to them, I thought, well, my parents subscribed to the New Yorker, and I knew they used cartoons, and I knew I was never going to sell anything there because, you know, my stuff didn't fit in at all there, but, you know, what the hey? So I called up. I found out when their drop-off day was, which is when, you know, people who are not on staff just bring in a portfolio and they drop it off at the sort of outer office, and then you go back the next week to pick up your stuff and with a rejection note inside. So it was a Wednesday, and I went in and I did not really know too much what I was doing. I was 23, and I put everything I had, I think about 60 cartoons, in this envelope. And I dropped it off, and I went back the next week to pick it up, fully expecting not even that, not even bracing myself for disappointment, because I was so fully expected that this was not going to be my home. And when I looked inside the envelope, there was a note from the art editor, Lee Lorenz, to come back and see him, which was very strange. And I remember thinking, well, I don't know what this is about. I hope he's not going to yell at me. Because that's my general sort of feeling about everything in life. When the phone rings, it's like, somebody's going to yell at me. Something's wrong. So I went back, and he pulled out this cartoon, and he said, we're going to buy this cartoon. And I was absolutely flabbergasted for two reasons. I was flabbergasted that they were buying anything, and this was definitely the weirdest of the lot. It was like the most personal. It was the kind of cartoon that I do when I'm like sitting by myself and I'm trying to make myself laugh, and it's like, Gabe. Well, I do this. Maybe you don't do this. I make up funny lists. I make up lists of, you know, ridiculous movie titles or fake words or funny names or just silly things, because that's what I do. I like to make myself laugh. So when they first started running my stuff, though, there were people who were very, very upset. And Lee didn't tell me. There were a couple of canceled subscriptions because I think people felt like the barbarians are not just at the gate. They are through the gate. They are, like, setting up shop. This is not good. And Lee did tell me to come back every week with new cartoons and to, you know, meet in the office with the other staff people, which was kind of astonishing. But anyway, Lee told me later that one of the older cartoonists asked him if he owed my family money. So, yeah. This is another very early cartoon. This is, I had a very... I lived in this wonderful apartment that I loved so much, but it did not have a stove. But it did have a very, very hot radiator. This is another very early cartoon. This is The Cranes, 1,022,796 West 79th Street. And I'll tell you this funny thing about this cartoon, the reason why I like to include it, because, and I'll get into this a little bit later, the way it works is that we all submit, all the cartoonists, when we turn in our work for the week, it's called, for some reason, The Batch. I don't know, it was called The Batch when I started, it's still called The Batch. You turn in your batch, and there are sketches. So there's like 6, 8, 10 sketches of cartoons. And if they buy a cartoon, you take the sketch and then you do a finish. And back in the day, you'd go in person, if you lived in the New York area, which I did, and Lee pulls this sketch out of this cartoon, and it's the same gag, but I have the flag on the side of the mailbox. It's attached to the door of the mailbox and sticking out perpendicularly. And he said, you know, we're buying this cartoon, but I have to ask you, what is that? And I said, oh, that's the handle that you open up the mailbox with. And I think then he realized I had never had a mailbox like this. I grew up in an apartment house, and then I went to college, you know, I never had one of these mailboxes. So he actually drew a mailbox on my sketch and explained the mechanics of the mailbox and what it was for and everything. And like I don't want to show off or anything, but I have one of these now. And like, I just flip up that flag like I've done it my whole life. It's, you know, amazing. I don't need any help. I just do it myself. This is the freelance life. That brings me, as I said, I'm going to talk a little bit about process. This is where I work. I work at home. It's my desk. You can see my brushes and all my stuff. Glue, scissors, whatever. There's about 40 of us on staff, 40 staff cartoonists. And we each do, as I said, this batch of cartoons every week, which we submit. I usually submit between 6 and 8 drawings. Some people do more, some people do less. And then some people bring them in person. I think back in the day, maybe some people faxed. I send mine through cyberspace. This is a photo of cartoons going through cyberspace. And then they go to an art meeting. And you have to do a little bit of math here, which is a challenge for me, but I'll try to keep it like round numbers. So you have 40 cartoonists, let's say, we each submit 10 cartoons. That's 400. And then at least another 400 come in over the transom. So from like non-staff people. So you have something like 800 at least cartoons every week that have to be winnowed down. They buy about 20 to 25 a week. So these original 800 cartoons get winnowed down to about 100, which go to an art meeting. And I have never been to this art meeting, but I imagine it looks a lot like this. And it really is mostly this, which is why if somebody, you know, asks me, you know, my kid or I want to, or my niece or nephew, they want to do this, what's your advice? I say, well, if they can do anything else, they should probably do that thing. Because really, it's mostly rejection. You have to really want to do this. And my rejects, I put them in, now the file cabinets are full, they're piled up on top. And I do sometimes resubmit them. I get that asked that question a lot, and there's nothing weird about that. I mean, resubmissions, it's part of the process of, because sometimes they reject a cartoon that I really like, and I'll take the opportunity maybe a couple months later or a year later to, you know, change it, to look at it again, say, can I make it better? Can I make it funnier? Can I change up the words or take something out or just, because I you know, after submitting it four or five times, I might retire it. But, you know, I don't want them to, you know, call me up and be mad at me. You know, my greatest fear of all. But you know, if I believe in something, I'll resubmit it. And sometimes they do buy it because, you know, it could be that that week they're not in the mood for a joke about, like, shoes or something. You know, you don't know. Anyway, I'm going to show a few more cartoons. This is Urban Trail Mix. And this is just a sort of I do like death jokes. I guess there's really nothing sort of more horrible or more funny, which brings me to the next topic. I got very obsessed with embroidery, and this is an embroidery I did a few months ago. It's one of my very favorite quotes from a Polish poet called Czesław Miłosz. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. When a writer is born into a family, the family is finished. And I think that's probably true. And this is a book I wrote about my parents in 2014. It was published. Can't we talk about something more pleasant? It's about, thanks. It's about my parents, it's about them as individuals, about their relationship with each other, about their relationship with me, and it focuses on the last 10 years or so of their lives, although as I was writing it, I had to go a little bit more into the background. These are some of the stories that I heard growing up. The Wheel of Doom. These are real stories. I mean, it's just insane. Maybe when you live long enough, like, everything bad that can possibly happen happens, you know. Friend's husband killed by falling flower pot. Friend nearly blinded by mascara causing infection. Friend who traveled too much. Jaundice. A rash, then dead. A headache, then dead. A lump, then dead. He was too happy. He jumped off a chair and broke his metatarsal. Guy who almost died after playing the oboe. This is a friend of my mother's brother who was a professional jazz musician. That one day I overheard this conversation when I was about 9 years old. He woke up and he was bleeding from every pore. And you know when you're like a kid and you read something or you hear something and you wish you had not heard it? You wish you could just like unhear something? Well, that like really flipped me out. And the reason for this was because, apparently, according to my mother and her brother, neither of whom are medical professionals, was because it was so hard to get a note out of that oboe. All that pressure, years, years and years of playing the oboe, that one morning, you know. And then my parents had other, like, weird things. Like, if you got water in your ear, you might as well kill yourself. You know, that was like the insane, if you got water in your ear. I was so afraid of getting water in my ears. I swam with a bathing cap until I was like 17. I mean, that's not a good look, you know, for anybody. It's just not. It's just not good at all. Sitting directly on the ground. My mother told me that when she was growing up, her best friend sat directly on the ground. She caught a cold in her kidneys, and she died. I once found this bracelet that was like an expandable bracelet on the sidewalk, and I put it on. My mother said, take that off. It's too tight. Your hand will get gangrene and drop off. It was just a disaster. And yet, my parents and I never really, really discussed death. And I would have these conversations with them. So, you guys ever think about things? What kinds of things? You know, things, plans. I have no idea what you guys want. Let's say something happened. Am I the only sane person here? You know what? Forget it. Never mind. Que sera, sera. Later that same day. Phew. 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 Like, none of us wanted to talk about this. And this is like a typical conversation. This is literally a conversation I would have with my mother, visiting. Mom, what is with this oven mitt? It's from the year one. It's disgusting. It's all burnt and cruddy, and it's got patches on it. And then realizing, oh my God, these patches come from a skirt I made 40 years ago in home ec. Please let me buy you a new oven mitt. She says, why waste your money? That one still works. Well, you know, the book sort of goes into the whole trajectory. And at the end, my father passed away at 95, my mother at 97, 2 years later. And it was not, the last few years were not good. And they really had not given me much guidance for what they wanted, as I mentioned. And so at the end of my book, they were their cremains were in my closet. And I really did not know what else to do with them. Everything seemed so random, you know, like the idea of just kind of like randomly burying them. And I just had no idea. Anyway, I got a letter from a total stranger. And this was in the New Yorker. I'll read this because there's an epilogue. About a year and a half ago, I received an email from a woman who had read a book I wrote about my parents. Dear Roschast, I read your book, blah, 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 but there was a mystery that needed to be solved. I should interject here that before I was born, 12 years before I was born, my parents had a baby that died. And it was a real terrible situation. My mother almost died. I think it was terrifying for my mother, terrifying certainly for my father. The baby lived a couple of days. They never wanted to talk about it. When it did come up, my mother would refer to it as that mess. They were just, it was just too charged. Anyway, this woman reassured me that she wasn't Bats, that she was merely curious about where my parents' first baby was buried. Her curiosity led her to a website called Find a Grave, this is true, where she discovered something she thought I might find interesting. Chas, female, died December 21st, 1942. Buried Mount Lebanon Cemetery in Queens. It's a Jewish cemetery. I did find it interesting. It was more information than I was able to get from my parents. So I contacted Mount Lebanon, you know, on my laptop. Dear Sirs and Madams, blah, blah, blah. Archive, George and Elizabeth Chast, baby, 1940, around there. The next day, I received this message. Dear Roz, I believe you have found your sister. I was way beyond flabbergasted. Not only had my sister turned up in the archives, but so had my mother's parents. This was all news to me. The man at the cemetery sent me photographs of their graves. My parents' ashes, which had been in my closet since their deaths in 2007 and 2009, had at last found a home. Several months passed. After all, there was no rush. This is true, right? Finally, last fall, my son and I took a subway and then a bus to Glendale, Queens, where Mount Lebanon Cemetery is. I didn't bring the cremains. It was a two-part process, and this part was mainly for paperwork. We met with a man who had found my sister and my grandparents. He showed us a book of archived cemetery maps and the precise place where my sister was buried. He took us to her gravesite, which was unmarked, common in the case of an infant's death. My son and I put stones on her grave. Jews don't put flowers on graves, just stones. He showed us the niche wall where my parents' cremains would be housed. It overlooks where your sister is buried. It's the only one left in that wall. It's niche J2. J2, the apartment where my parents had lived for almost 50 years, where I grew up, was 2J. The other day, I returned to Mount Lebanon, this time with a pal and my parents' cremains. You can see a little photograph of me that my friend took. I'm on the subway platform with this bag, rather heavy bag. I was tempted to say to my fellow L-train passengers, guess what or who is in this bag? A workman drove me out to the niche wall. I carried the bag on my lap. We were joined by a group of workmen at the wall. One of them climbed a ladder, opened the niche, and one by one placed my parents' ashes inside. Then he resealed it and climbed back down. It was time to say goodbye. And here's a picture of them. One thing about this picture that gets me is that it's about 1960, but my parents are dressed like it's 1938. And I think that this is like the last time, that was the last time they actually like looked and saw what other people were wearing. It's really, I mean, this is how they dressed. They were very old fashioned. And this is a picture of me. I am not 40 years old in this picture. I'm 11. I'm in Brooklyn. I do not speak much English. I come off boat. I don't know what boat. I just wear babushka and hope no one get mad at me. And that brings me to my new book, which is called Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York. This is the picture on the in the middle there of me with my mother is based on this photograph. And it's a picture of me standing with my mother. I must be about 4 years old. I'm not sure exactly how many sweaters I'm wearing under that coat. I look like my head is going to pop off. It's like, my mother looks sort of normal. I just look like, what is happening? And the pants, I know I wore my cousin's like hand-me-down clothes, but like this is ridiculous. And this is Newkirk Station. I love the signs, buy tokens at your leisure. It's like, who else's leisure am I buying the tokens at, you know? It says, insert dime and nickel and receive one token. So it was 15 cents. Anyway, you might say, well, if you love New York so much, why did you leave? And I have a little explanation here. When our son was almost three and I was pregnant with our second child, my husband, our son, and I left Brooklyn. We were living in Park Slope at that point. In Brooklyn, neighborhood in Brooklyn, for a pretty leafy suburb about an hour north of Manhattan. There were five main reasons for this leap into the unknown. One, this was 1990, the middle of the crack epidemic. We'd had it with the crime, the crack vials all over the sidewalk, all of it. This is my son. Mommy, what that? I eat that. Two, free, excellent public schools where we were going. Three, my parents lived in Brooklyn. For some people, this would have been a plus, but I had mixed feelings. Four, sometimes when you grow up in a place, you need to get away. I saw Brooklyn differently from people who came there from Wisconsin or wherever. Behind every cute organic food store, I saw the ghost of the sad, dark, odoriferous gross red of my childhood. There was nothing there for me. Five, but the main reason was this. We couldn't afford the space we needed. The four-bedroom house we bought in suburbia cost less than a crappy two-bedroom walk-up in Brooklyn, even in 1990. The decision to leave the city was terrifying. This is my son. Must play soccer. My daughter is need mall now. My husband, lawn, extremely important. And I'm hell with art, collect thimbles instead. I didn't know how to drive. I didn't like the idea of living directly on top of a boiler or a furnace or whatever the hell was in a house basement. I'd never lived in what my parents called the country. When we first moved up to Connecticut, my father actually asked me, "So how many channels did you get up there?" I mean, to them, we were like moving to like the Yukon territories. Also, would we turn into Philistines or zombies? And this still is like how I feel a lot of the time. I'm on my lawn and I'm thinking, I own this tree. It makes no sense to me at all. So I took my kids into the city with me a lot because we were really only about an hour and change outside of the city. And I wanted them to love the city. I wanted them to explore it with me. But my daughter, she actually looked at the fire escapes, and she didn't know what they were. And she said, "Mom, what are all those West Side Story things?" And it killed me because it's not like I had no idea how she knew the graphic of that fire escape, because we didn't have, I mean, first of all, we didn't have albums lying around, you know, so I didn't know when she'd seen it, but somehow that graphic, I guess, is part of the culture, but she didn't know what they were. Anyway, the origin of this book was really a booklet that I made for my daughter before she went to college. As our kids were growing up, I frequently took them into the city. I wanted them to share my love for my hometown. But about a week before my daughter left for college in Manhattan, I decided to check up on her sense of logistics. So, you know, I told her, you can't really get lost in Manhattan from most of Manhattan. It's a grid. And she said, what do you mean? So I got a piece of paper. I'm like, these are the avenues. These are the streets. So if you want to go from 52nd Street to 55th Street, you have to walk 3 blocks uptown. And she said to me, what's a block? Yeah, so I realized we had some work to do. And I made her this little booklet, just Nina's basic New York City book focusing on the borough of Manhattan, because that's where her school was. And it was, you know, maybe like 12, 14 pages, and it had stuff like, it had little maps in it, it had a lot of cartoons and funny, hopefully funny drawings. It had stuff about how Fifth Avenue divides the east side from the west side, very basic stuff that sometimes guidebooks don't tell you. Guidebooks will tell you places to go, but they don't always tell you the architecture of the city, like the underlying organizational parts of it. You know, this is the east side, this is the west side, Fifth Avenue does this, Central Park is here, these are the most important cross streets. This is what a cross street is, because I realized she had never heard the term cross street. Where the most important museums are, just how to take the subway, you know, and what the shuttle is, and how the shuttle, you know, connects 42nd Street, why you should know this, it connects the east side and the west side, just very basic stuff. When I gave her that book, I had this hope that if she had the right tools for getting around the city and, of course, some luck, because one always needs luck, especially in New York, she would fall in love with the city the way I did when I was just a few years older than her. I wanted to introduce her to Manhattan and didn't want them to get off on the wrong foot. So I'm just saying, play nice. But as I was writing it, I realized that it was more than just a guidebook. It was also my own personal, like, I want you to know this because I love this city so much, and these are the things that I love about it. And some of the things are kind of weird. Like, I actually love this idea, even though it's disturbing. The sidewalk in New York is like a thin shell covering a vast honeycomb of pipes and tunnels. The ground under which you are walking has been almost completely excavated. It is best if you don't think about this. It is just crazy. If you've ever seen a cross section, it just, you know, I mean, I've seen like little subway things here, but when you're in the subway in New York and you're like 4 stories down and you realize this was built like 100 years ago, it can be a little disconcerting. For some reason, I've always preferred cities to nature. I am interested in the person made. I like to watch and eavesdrop on people, and I really like density of visual information. And this is something I love in New York. And other cities have this too, but I think because of the geography of New York, because it's an island and it can't expand outward, it just gets denser and denser and denser. And you can pick any like crummy street in Midtown, and it's still, there are plenty of crummy streets in Midtown. And you just look and it's like, you know, stores on top of stores, Acme Furs, Ice Skating Supplies, Persateria, Air Conditioner Repair School, Ventriloquism School, Vitamins, Wigs, Buttons, Brass Polishers Union, Smoothies, Dresses, Cheese House, Snaps and More, Walk-in Clinic, Chessboards. It's just this jumble of stuff, and I just love that. I don't know why. The more nondescript your street is, the greater chance you have of making your own discoveries. And this is a woman walking into the store, and it's, this store sells 90 jabillion kinds of ribbon. And I don't even want ribbon, you know? I just like that it's there. I like being able to walk in, and it's like, here is this ribbon that for some reason has little, like, lanterns sewn onto it, like every, that dangle down every 6 inches. What would I do with this? Would I put it on the bottom of a skirt? No. What, you know, but I love that somebody made it and somebody is selling it and obviously somebody is doing something with it. This was very exciting to me. And then just like the detail on the street, it's like for me discovering a new species of standpipe is like discovering a new plant, you know. it's just like a botanist, you know, and also I like them because they're very anthropomorphic. Like this one on the left, I think of her as Trixie. And she's very saucy, and I think if you look at her for a while, you'll know what I'm saying. And I think Trixie might be a little bit into some S&M. And then the upper right-hand corner, this is definitely like some doofus. He's like, nobody can see me. I'm sneaking out between the railings. And it's like, everybody can see you. You're an idiot. And this couple, this is an old married couple. They're like stuck in that like disgusting snowbank or something. It's and they've just had a fight. And she says to him, she says, I'm not talking to you. And he says, what did I do? And she says, you know what you did. I'm not talking to you. Don't even look at me. I'm not even here. So, and then there's like this, like, what is that? Like, where do these pipes go? Where do they come from? What are they doing? Like, what is that? It's like this little family that just like sprang up from the ground. And then I had to take pictures of these because I knew if I drew this, nobody would believe me. When I saw it, it was just like, well, this is obviously the god of all standpipes. And we should really be like worshiping in front of it or leaving offerings or something of I don't know what, maybe like gravel or something. Maybe that's what that white at the bottom is. I have no idea. And then there was just like the walking around, kind of the weird stuff that for some reason always seems to happen when I'm in New York. The conversations that you have with people in stores. This was at around 10:15 in the morning. And I went into this, like, cosmetic store. It was before Sephora, so it was some off-brand place. And this woman says, hi, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'm looking for a new lipstick. And she gets very excited, and she says, you should try our special line. Put it on in the morning, and it never comes off. And then she points to her mouth. She goes, look, I just ate a salad. And it was so bizarre. Plus, I'm thinking, who eats a salad at 10:15 in the morning? Like, I have never heard of such a thing. And then this story, this ran in the New Yorker, this was so weird. This is called The Knife. A couple of weeks ago, on a night of unseasonable warmth, I was walking in the city. I was still getting used to the early darkness. Mostly I liked it. It made the day shorter. Yes, almost time for bed. The streets were jammed with people leaving work, students coming home from classes, tourists dragging suitcases, etc. I like to look at people, but in that sly, indirect way that people look at other people in the city. I was trained as a child growing up in the city to never, ever look a stranger in the eye because they could be a nut. I look away, I look at a building, another glance at the person, at a parking meter, at the ground, back at the person. My husband, who is from the Midwest, finds this peculiar. And he says, people are nice. And I'm like, yeah, maybe. Anyway, on this particular evening, as I was walking and looking and pretending not to look, something on the sidewalk caught my eye. It was a large chef's knife, sheathed in white cardboard. It looked as if it had been newly purchased and accidentally dropped. I picked it up and put it in my bag. Not every day one finds a chef's knife, I thought. And then I completely forgot about it. I kept walking. I wasn't tired, and the city was filled with wonderful distractions. I met my daughter for dinner at an Italian restaurant. We ate and drank and yakked for a long time. It was such a nice night that after dinner, we started walking uptown. I just had a brainstorm. Let's go to the top of the Empire State Building. And she says, okay. I hadn't been up there in 30 years. My daughter had never been. Sometimes it's actually fun to do a touristy thing. And there certainly had been some changes since then. Because there's security, you know. And I completely, you know, didn't know that. You know, where you put your bag on the conveyor belt and it goes through the machine. And suddenly there's all these, like, guards standing around. And one of them says to me, "Ma'am, do you have a knife in your bag?" And I'm like, "Well, there's a teeny tiny one on my Swiss Army keychain." And he pulls out this chef's knife. And then, you know, like, as I've said many times tonight, like, I don't like it when people are mad at me. So, like, I get, like, kind of yakky. And it's like, "Well, you see, I was walking along. I found it on the sidewalk and forgot about it. And my daughter and I, we had dinner and we blah, 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 blah. And here we are." They believed me, but they confiscated the knife and said I could reclaim it when we came back down from the observation deck. I never bothered. Out of the ether it came, back into the ether it went. And I have a section in the book also about going to museums. My favorite museum in the world is the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I think because it is just endless. You can never come to the end of that museum. I've been there so many times, and I will always see something I've never seen before. But I like to, you know, make up stories for some of the paintings. I also, this is my favorite period of art, is the very early Renaissance, when some of the rules of perspective were in place, but not all of them. And you get things like, "Well, we think that house is, like, that house is pretty good. I think it's good." And the guy knows, like, it's not right. But, you know, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. So now here's the story. It's like, you know, "Oh, wise men, forgive me for making your house levitate." And he says, "Perhaps you didn't mean to, but still you must be punished." And they're all like, "Yeah, goody." And then this painting, I think of this as "Put something on." "Put this on. You can't go around naked." "No. Put it on." "No. Put it on, damn it. Bite me." Look at their faces. It's so great. Or you can get fashion tips. "Next time you get your hair cut, ask for a Zazera." Isn't that great? This is what, like, if you were in with fashion in late 15th century Venice, you know, you'd get, "Give me a Zazz." You know? And then I have a chapter about food. One of the most pleasant things about Manhattan, as opposed to, say, Death Valley, is the unlikelihood that you will run out of food or water. Nevertheless, my father used to carry a little bit of food with him whenever he went into town. But that's what my parents used to call it. They didn't say going into the city like everybody else. They called it going into town. He would take a banana, a wax paper bag with a piece of honey cake in it, a plastic bag containing a stack of graham crackers. At some point, he'd announce to my mother, "Elizabeth, I feel like chewing on something." And then out would come the honey cake or whatever. My mother hated when he used that expression, "chewing on something." But he used it all the time anyway. But don't feel like you have to carry around your own personal roast chicken. For food is one thing Manhattan is not short of. From your monthly rent equals dinner, not including drinks, type places, to the humblest sidewalk stand. And when I was a kid, the hot dog stands, we always called them dirty water dogs. I don't know why. I wonder why. In Manhattan, every food, ethnicity, preference, aversion, allergy, craving, fad, or combination of the above is represented. If you can't find what you want to eat here, maybe you don't like food. And this is just a whole bunch of stuff. Kosher fondue, gluten-free pho, nothing but grits, no carb, all carb, a taste of Bulgaria, International House of Rabbit, you know, Senor Hitachi. That's, you know, that's sushi tacos, just anything. One of my favorite books about New York was E.B. White's book, Here is New York. So in 1949, E.B. White wrote one of the best books ever written about New York City called Here is New York. In it, he wrote that there were essentially three New Yorks. First, there was the New York of the person who was born here, who takes the city for granted and accepts its size and its turbulence as natural and inevitable. Secondly, there is the New York of the daily commuter who arrives for work every morning and leaves every evening for home in the suburbs. You will almost never see this New Yorker wandering around aimlessly or sitting on a park bench. The commuter gives New York its tidal restlessness. Last of all is the New York of the person who was born somewhere else and came to New York in quest of something. And I love this quote so much. I love it not only because I think it really reveals such a deep truth about New York and what makes it so special, but also because I really do identify with all three of these New Yorks. I grew up there, and so for me, when I get off the train in Grand Central, you know, when I take the train from the suburbs into Grand Central, I breathe a sigh of relief. It's like I can relax now. There's something about the anonymity and the crowds, not the crowds around Christmas time, that's a bit too much, but just in general, having people around that I like. It's like this sort of the complete opposite of when I travel and when I go to a town and there are no people around and I don't understand it, especially like in the middle of the day. It's, you know, I'll be in some Phoenix or something and it's the middle of town and it's like 2 p.m. and there's like nobody on the street. And I think, you know, did a zombie apocalypse happen? Like, where is everybody? I don't understand this. Like, where's all the people just kind of walking around, you know, buying ribbon or whatever? And then, of course, the commuter. I mean, I've never commuted on a daily basis, but I do know what the commuter train is about. I've taken it all the time because I have driven into New York once. I will never do that again. And the last thing is the quest group. And for me, Manhattan and Brooklyn are both New York, but for when, especially my era of Brooklyn, I know there's a lot of young people who live in Brooklyn now, and there's parts of it that are very different from when I grew up. But when I grew up, Manhattan, for me, was the shining city on the hill, as it was for a lot of people. Brooklyn was very provincial. Not only did a lot of people in Brooklyn never go into Manhattan, but most of them never left their own neighborhoods. You know, you were like, your neighborhood was like this little world, and you knew where the edges were. The boundaries were often ethnic, and you just did not wander out of your little boundary. And Manhattan was a very different world. I started going in by myself when I was around 14. I started going to the Art Students League I think it was the first Saturday of every month. And that was really my introduction to a whole other New York. And it was really, when I got out of college and I moved to New York, it was the first place, the first time in my life I ever thought, well, maybe my life won't turn out to be this complete disaster that I always thought that, you know, by the time I finished, you know, high school and then went to college, and I just thought, this will not do. This is just not good. And Manhattan was the first place I felt like, actually, maybe there is hope. The book is not only a guide and a love letter, it's also a thank you letter. Anyway, here's a few more cartoons. This is Nancy Drew, The Later Years. Nancy Drew and the Missing House Keys. Nancy Drew and the Mystery of the 8 pounds. How did I gain 8 pounds? I eat nothing. Nancy Drew and the Secret of the Computer. You and I are going to be great friends. This is Dousing for Coffee. This is The Vain but Realistic Queen. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who if she lost 10 pounds and had her eyes and her neck done and had the right haircut could, in her age group, be the fairest one of all? I love those end of the world guys. Just love them. This is... Yeah. And I think we're going to finish up with this little film. I did a mural for the Museum of the City of New York. It was really crazy. It was the kind of thing where somebody mentions this to you and it's way in the future. So you say, sure, that'll work. And then it comes time to do it and you say, oh, no, 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 no. So this was all done over the period about 3 days, about 6 hours a day. And it was very big. You'll see from a couple of shots how big it was. It was really bananas. And it's called Subway Sofa. That's it. Good. I think we're going to open it up to Q&A now.
So who was the funny one in your family?
My son. He's the funniest.
I think I discovered your cartoon when I was about 19, and I carried one in particular in my wallet for years and years until it disintegrated. And then I later met somebody as I was pulling out some cash from my wallet, and he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, it's the voice of Binky." And he said, "I have the voice of Binky in my wallet." And then
did you marry him and have lots of little Binkies? And
and then I later came to meet two more people that carried the voice of Binky in their wallets.
That's so weird.
I just wanted to let you know that, I mean, we all kind of live by the voice of Binky.
Good.
So I'm an old Brooklynite, and I'm just wondering, have you gone back?
I've gone back a lot,
you know, and,
actually.
And how does that feel to you?
Well, Brooklyn is, it's different now, you know. I'm not just Brooklyn's different, but I'm different. And I'm exploring it a lot, not just my neighborhood, but it's just so big and really interesting. I mean, there's just so many neighborhoods that you don't really hear much about, you know, not talking about like Williamsburg or something like that and the place where, you know, fancy restaurants open up. But, you know, neighborhoods like Mill Basin and Flatlands, you know, just Gerritsen Beach, these crazy places that are Brooklyn, but they're just so far off the map. You've got to take like a subway and then a bus. It's crazy.
In a documentary on New Yorker cartoonists, at one point you got to a reception which was full of people who were A, much taller than you, and B, male. Is that world a man's world? And does it matter to you, or are you just off with your pencil and it only matters for an hour a week?
I don't go in person anymore. I haven't done that in a long time. It was when I started, it was predominantly male. There were just a couple of us gals there. But there are more women now, for sure. And our editor, cartoon editor, is Emma Allen, who's female. But I don't think about it that much. I mean, I have a lot of other issues that I'm anxious about.
I'm always curious, right after my husband does something stupid, you write a cartoon about it.
So, whatever do you mean?
And I have been reading The New Yorker since I was 12 years old, which is before God, but anyway, and it's just interesting. Well, I'll open up the new issue and I just type him a note and it says, page 37, like I said. And I just don't know, how do you do that?
That's funny. My husband never makes mistakes.
Hi. I was wondering how you developed your style, or was it conscious? Did you decide that, oh, my humor's sort of like this and I wanted my cartoons to sort of match my humor, or did it just happen? Like, what was the process?
Style is a very interesting thing. I think people come to their styles in very different ways. For me, I think of style a lot like handwriting. It's like how any kind of style, like your style of like how you present yourself, how you dress, or your handwriting, or the way you speak, or some of it is, you know, your natural inclination, and some of it is seeing something that, like, I've told this story before of being in first grade, and I knew from the time I was like 3 that I loved to draw, and so I always did, you know, draw. But I remember being in first grade, and I always drew people with their feet like this, you know, because I didn't know how to,
and there was this little, you know, out like that, like Charlie Chaplin, you know, and there was this little girl in my class, I still remember her name was Elise, and she drew the feet like rectangles, like sticking out. She had like a perspective thing going, and I kind of studied that for a while, and I took it. So I think it's a combination of you know, your natural inclination, and then sort of like, I'll do that. You know, that's better than what I did. So.
The first of your cartoons I ever saw was a dog's magazine with, the thing I remember best is Pleasantly Putrid or Dangerously Rotten for things found under the sofa. And I wanted to know if you have pets, and are they as good for material as children and spouses?
Children and spouses, I think, are better because they talk. And I have birds, though, and they're really interesting, but they don't. I don't have that many cartoons, really, about them. I think people are better. They do dumber things.
What did your parents think of your drawing? You started at three.
I think that they were just glad that I was doing something that I probably wouldn't die from. I mean, the main lessons growing up for me were like, don't die, don't get hurt, don't play too much with other children because they have impetigo and other things. Do well in school, stay, be quiet. Don't make a lot of noise, because we lived in an apartment, and also they were older and kind of cranky, and they were busy, and so I think that they thought that eventually I'd be an art teacher, and I allowed them to keep that illusion as long as possible. They were very proud. I mean, they subscribed to the New Yorker. I think we had very different senses of humor because they kind of came from this tradition. I often think about this. They told jokes, you know, these like set pieces, and they would often have these dinners where these other Brooklyn school teachers would come to dinner at the apartment, and they would sit around and they would tell jokes like, oh, I have a new one, you know, Sammy goes to the doctor, blah 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 blah. The doctor says, boom, punchline, and then everybody would laugh, and then, oh, that reminds me, but I can't think of the last time I went to a dinner party and people told jokes like that, you know. So it was different.
I want to say, first of all, your cartoons helped me and my mom discover that we have the same exact sense of humor. And secondly, I wanted to ask what your favorite room in the Metropolitan Museum of Art is and why.
I'm not sure what the number is, but my favorite room is the one that has a lot of early Italian Renaissance paintings, like Fra Angelico and like that pink floating house and with those little detailed landscapes. I think partly because they suggest stories to me, but also because visually I like a lot of detail, and I like flatness, and I like colors. And also I like the way that era, you could see that they had some of the information. They weren't like all perfect yet. They were like on their way to some sort of perfection that would come later. But there's just parts that like aren't quite right, like that pink floating house, and I just, that gets me, you know? I don't know, I just like, that's my favorite room. It has a bunch of that stuff.
How does your daughter feel about Manhattan?
She doesn't live there. She lives in Maine. But my son, yeah, a little different. But my son lives in Manhattan. So, and he loves it, and he actually once told me, it was almost kind of like, he just said, you know, Mom, I don't know, I'm just like kind of really happy here, and he was almost like surprised and kind of like, I don't know, I have to admit it, you know, I kind of like it here. So, yeah, anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.